You know, there is this this scene that plays out in offices and break rooms literally all over the
Oh,
world.
yeah, probably every single day.
Right, exactly. And if you have ever worked in a corporate environment, you have definitely witnessed some version of this. So imagine a woman named Ashley. She's, grabbing her morning coffee, and she overhears three of her coworkers at the water cooler.
Let me guess, talking about their kids.
You got it. They are young moms, and they are practically high-fiving each other, just sharing these massive, triumphant victories about their babies finally sleeping through the night.
The holy grail of early parenting.
Totally. And Ashley, she just, she chuckles. She joins in, making a little self-deprecating joke about how she has completely forgotten what a full night's sleep even feels like.
Yeah, which is a very familiar, almost reflexive kind of masking. You just smile through the absolute exhaustion so you don't ruin the mood for everyone else.
Yeah. Because what those coworkers don't realize is that for Ashley, who is a mother to older children on the autism spectrum, this isn't some nostalgic joke about the newborn phase.
Right, she's not reminiscing.
Exactly. She's not looking back at a difficult time that she eventually conquered. For her, the exhaustion is strictly present tense. She is living by a completely different set of milestones. In her home, the struggle of not sleeping through the night is, well, it's an ongoing nightly ordeal.
Which is a reality that so many people who, who don't have a neurodivergent child simply cannot fathom. I mean, the finish line for sleep just keeps moving.
Yeah.
You think you're going to cross it at 6 months, then 2 years, then 5 years, and eventually you just realize the race is on a totally different track altogether.
And that brings us to our mission for this deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a highly comprehensive framework, literally updated today, April 15th, 2026, all about the incredibly complex intersection of autism and sleep.
It is such a vital topic.
It really is. We are going to explore the biological why behind this, the really intense nighttime realities these families actually face, and most importantly, some highly actionable strategies to, reclaim rest.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if you look at the raw numbers, Ashley's situation is not an anomaly. Not at all.
Not even close,
No,
rather.
estimates consistently show that between 50% to 80% of children on the autism spectrum experience significant sleep problems.
Wow, up to 80%.
Yeah, that makes them 2 to 3 times more likely to suffer from these sleep disturbances compared to neurotypical kids.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to realize this isn't just about, waking up feeling a bit groggy.
Definitely not.
If you've ever tracked your own sleep on a smartwatch and seen how terrible you feel after a few bad nights, just multiply that by years.
It's staggering to even think about.
Right. When a developing brain is chronically deprived of restorative rest, it profoundly alters cognitive development. I mean, it impairs their capacity for learning, emotional regulation, and just basic executive function.
And the blast radius of that exhaustion completely disrupts the entire family's quality of life, too.
Oh, absolutely. You have whole households functioning on fumes, just operating in this state of constant hypervigilance.
So to figure out how to actually solve a problem this massive, we first have to understand the mechanics. And it's baffling in a way because autistic babies generally show completely normal sleeping behavior early on.
Wait, really? Early on, it's normal.
Yeah, exactly. During those first few months of life, they ease into typical cycles of sleep and wakefulness. They consolidate their naps. They sleep longer stretches at night, pretty much just like any other infant.
But then biology just sort of stops building on itself. There's this distinct divergence that happens right around infancy. Usually, that's the critical window where a child's brain begins to develop mature, lifelong sleep architecture. But for many autistic children, that biological transition just misfires.
They hit a developmental wall.
Exactly. And without intervention, that struggle to initiate or maintain sleep can persist straight into school age and, well, way beyond.
And researchers point to a whole cluster of contributing neurological factors for that misfire. First, you have heightened sensory processing.
Right, the sensory overload.
Yeah. I mean, think about how a neurotypical brain naturally filters out the hum of a refrigerator or like the texture of a bed sheet to allow the nervous system to power down.
We just tune it out completely.
Exactly. But an autistic brain often lacks that filtering mechanism. They are receiving this barrage of light, sound, and tactile input, at full volume.
Which has to be exhausting.
It is. And it keeps the autonomic nervous system locked in a state of sympathetic arousal. I mean, you try falling asleep when your brain thinks you're standing in the middle of Times Square.
You physically can't do it.
No.
And compounding that environmental overload is the chemical dysregulation. We know that in autistic individuals, melatonin production doesn't follow the typical curve.
The timing is just way off.
Yeah, the circadian rhythm gets completely skewed because the brain isn't releasing that hormone at the right time or in the right quantities to signal the onset of the biological night.
Which leads to a very specific structural deficit in their sleep architecture, namely a significant reduction in REM sleep.
Which is the restorative part, right?
Exactly. Some studies actually suggest autistic kids may experience up to 10% less REM sleep than their neurotypical peers.
And missing out on that specific phase is devastating for neurodevelopment. I mean, if you're losing 10% of your REM sleep every single night, your brain isn't effectively consolidated memories from the day.
It's not processing emotional experiences properly either.
Right. It's like leaving your computer running like a million background programs without ever letting it reboot and install updates.
Yeah.
That deficit alone is a major driver of what families often refer to as autism sleep regressions.
Then you layer the physical comorbidities on top of that already fragile sleep architecture. A huge percentage of autistic children deal with overlapping conditions.
Like what kind of conditions?
Well, take gastrointestinal distress, for instance. The gut-brain axis is heavily impacted in autism, meaning chronic acid reflux or intestinal inflammation is constantly sending distress signals back to the brain.
Oh, man. Trying to sleep with severe heartburn is awful.
It's the worst. Add in high anxiety, which basically acts as an engine that just refuses to idle, and you have a nervous system that simply cannot mentally switch off.
Okay, but out of all the biological mechanisms we're discussing, here's where it gets really interesting. One of the major theories regarding this divergence comes down to difficulty reading social cues.
This is such a fascinating part of the research.
When I first processed that, I thought, what do social cues have to do with the physical act of falling asleep? But then it clicked. It's like being dropped into a foreign country where you don't speak the language and you don't know the local closing times.
That is a highly accurate way to visualize it.
Yeah.
How do you see that playing out in the evening routine?
Well, picture a neurotypical child in a busy household. They see their siblings putting on pajamas. They notice the overhead lights being dimmed. They hear the water running in the bathroom for teeth brushing.
All those ambient signals.
Right. Their brain effortlessly translates those ambient social environmental cues into an internal biological signal. Like, oh, the tribe is shutting down for the night. My body should initiate the sleep process too.
It's automatic.
Exactly. But for an autistic child, that bridge between observation and internal biological shift doesn't naturally exist. They might visually register the teeth brushing, but they are missing the environmental memo that tells their endocrine system to start winding down.
And because that memo gets lost in translation, the cues that seamlessly regulate a neurotypical brain, well, they have to be manually coded and explicitly taught.
Manually coded, yeah.
Because the root causes here are so deeply entrenched in neurology. The sensory gating issues, the skewed melatonin timelines, the missed social cues, the resulting midnight disruptions are a completely different animal than a neurotypical toddler just staying up late to test boundaries.
Which means the actual manifestations of these sleep issues in the middle of the night are wildly complex. When you have all these neurological misfires happening simultaneously, what does that actually look like for these families at 2 a.m.?
Well, you end up with a few distinct categories of parasomnias and disruptions. The absolute most prevalent is sleep onset insomnia.
Just getting to sleep in the first place.
Exactly. And this isn't your standard tossing and turning for 20 minutes. This is a profound, prolonged inability to initiate sleep, sometimes lasting for hours, because the nervous system is just refusing to downregulate.
You also see physical disruptions acting as severe roadblocks. I mean, sleep apnea is incredibly common, causing these micro-awakenings all night long as the child repeatedly stops breathing and gasps for air.
Terrifying for a parent to watch, by the way.
Oh, I can't even imagine. But what really stood out to me in the sources is the mechanism behind the high rates of bedwetting. It's not just a behavioral accident.
No, it's deeply neurological.
Right. It's heavily tied to delayed interoception, which is the brain's ability to perceive internal bodily signals. Because autistic children often achieve toilet training much later, their brains haven't mastered the ability to, like, hold the bladder or wake up specifically to use the bathroom.
And once they wake up wet, their fragile sleep architecture just shatters.
Exactly, and they cannot transition back into sleep mode.
Another fascinating, though exhausting, manifestation is rhythmic movement disorder. You will see children engaging in repetitive headbanging or intense body rocking right before or even during sleep.
Which looks alarming from the outside, but it actually serves a vital biological purpose for them, right?
Yes, it provides intense vestibular and proprioceptive stimulation. It's a deep, unconscious, self-soothing mechanism. The brain is basically trying to forcefully override the scattered sensory input by providing one massive rhythmic input to calm the nervous system down.
It's like drowning out the static with a single loud beat.
That's a great way to put it. Unfortunately, while it might eventually help them crash, it severely degrades the overall quality of their rest.
But perhaps the most jarring distinction parents have to navigate is the critical difference between nightmares and autism night terrors.
Oh, this is so important to clarify.
The documentation is very explicit about separating these two because treating them requires totally opposite approaches. If you've dealt with a nightmare, you know it's rooted in a dream narrative.
Right. The child wakes up, they are scared by the monster in the dream, but they are fully conscious.
Exactly. And they can be verbally comforted. You can talk them down.
Autism night terrors, however, are a complete neurological disconnect. These are episodes of intense, visceral panic that occur while the child is still trapped in a sleep state.
So they aren't even awake?
No. The motor cortex is firing. They might be screaming, thrashing, or sweating profusely.
Yeah.
But their consciousness is effectively offline. The terror is completely untethered from any dream narrative. And here's the hardest part for parents. If you try to comfort them or shake them awake, you often prolong the episode because you are injecting unexpected sensory input into a system that is already short-circuiting.
When you lay it all out like that, insomnia, micro-awakenings from apnea, rhythmic headbanging, and night terrors, it completely recontextualizes daytime behavior.
Completely.
I mean, if an autistic child is already navigating a world that causes them immense sensory friction during the day, how does this chronic starvation of REM sleep compound what we see in the classroom or the therapy clinic?
The compounding effect is devastating because poor sleep essentially strips away whatever fragile coping mechanisms the child has managed to build.
They just have nothing left in the tank.
Exactly. Without that nightly neurological reset, emotional regulation goes out the window. We see severe spikes in aggression, hyperactivity, and depressive symptoms. Furthermore, coping behaviors like obsessive-compulsive rituals become significantly more rigid and prominent.
Because their exhausted brain is desperately grasping for predictability in an environment it can no longer process.
Exactly. The brain needs to control something. And long-term, this chronic deprivation acts as a massive headwind against their overall development.
It slows everything down.
It does. You simply cannot lay down new neural pathways or synthesize new behavioral therapies efficiently when the brain is chronically starved for deep sleep.
And the ripple effect on the parents is just as severe. Data gathered from communities like Angel Sense reveals the brutal toll this takes on the caregivers.
The burnout is very real.
It is. Autism parents sleep significantly less overall. Their sleep architecture is highly fragmented because they are essentially sleeping with one ear open, and they wake up much earlier than parents of neuroatypical children.
They're constantly on alert,
leading to a profound systemic caregiver burnout, like Ashley at the water cooler. She's not just tired from a rough night. She is absorbing the physiological stress of running a marathon every single night for years.
Which means the first step isn't just handing out generic sleep advice. It's stopping the marathon. Mm. You have to figure out exactly how severe the deficit is before you can implement a targeted fix.
So how do families actually measure this baseline? We know the targets vary by age. Toddlers need around 12 to 14 hours. School-aged kids need 10 to 11. And teenagers need 8 to 9.
Right. Those are the standard benchmarks.
But to figure out where a neurodivergent child falls on that spectrum, the assessment toolkit has to be pretty robust, doesn't it?
It does. It generally starts with subjective tracking. Parents are tasked with maintaining rigorous sleep diaries over a week or two, logging every wake-up, every meltdown, and every environmental factor, combined with standardized clinical questionnaires.
That sounds like a lot of work for a sleep-deprived parent.
It is exhausting, frankly. But when those behavioral logs don't provide a clear answer, the assessment moves to objective physiological testing.
Usually that means polysomnography, which is a formal clinic sleep study where they hook up electrodes to track brain waves, oxygen levels, and muscle movement.
Yes, the gold standard in typical sleep medicine.
But here's the catch for this specific demographic. How do you get accurate sleep data from an autistic child with severe tactile sensitivities when you're trying to glue 20 wires to their scalp in a strange hospital bed?
You often can't. The clinical environment itself ruins the sleep study.
Right, it completely skews the data.
That's why actigraphy has become such a crucial diagnostic tool. It relies on a sophisticated wearable device, similar to a high-end smartwatch, that tracks complex movement and sleep-wake patterns over several
Oh,
weeks.
that's brilliant. So they don't have to go to a lab.
Exactly. The child gets to stay in their own bed, in their natural sensory environment, and the device provides a highly accurate map of their circadian rhythm and nocturnal awakenings without triggering a sensory meltdown.
Okay, so once you have that objective data and you know exactly what is misfiring, you have to implement the fixes.
Time for the action plan.
Right. And I was looking through the established protocols for sleep hygiene in the source, keeping the bedroom at a cool temperature, using heavy blackout curtains, zero electronics or blue light before bed, cutting out late afternoon caffeine, and implementing a strict 20 to 30 minute wind down routine.
Very familiar device.
Yeah, and I have to push back a little here because to a lot of people listening, this just sounds like standard run-of-the-mill parenting advice, like don't give your kid an iPad and a soda at 9 p.m. What makes this uniquely crucial for an autistic child?
What's fascinating here is the absolute distinction between a suggestion and a prerequisite. For a neurotypical child, an inconsistent bedtime or an extra hour of screen time might be a speed bump.
They might be cranky the next day.
Exactly, it results in a cranky morning,
Yeah.
but their internal clock will eventually recalibrate.
Yeah.
But because of the delayed melatonin production and the intense sensory gating issues we discussed earlier, these standard tips act as a brick wall for an autistic child.
So there's zero wiggle room.
None. They are rigid neurological requirements. If the room isn't pitch black, their brain will not produce melatonin, period.
Ah, so it's not about optimizing sleep, it's about manually constructing the biological environment that their body refuses to create on its own.
Yes, perfectly said. And beyond the environment, the interventions have to be highly tailored to the autistic experience. For instance, the use of social stories.
I saw that mentioned. Can you explain how that works?
It's a brilliant behavioral intervention. Because we know these children miss the natural ambient cues of the household winding down, social stories use explicit, customized visual narratives to teach the child the exact sequence of bedtime.
Oh, I see.
It manually bridges that biological disconnect by turning an abstract concept into a concrete, predictable script.
There's also a massive emphasis on teaching the child the skill of independent sleep, which sounds nearly impossible when they're struggling so much. But the rationale is undeniable.
It is incredibly tough, but so necessary.
Because of the fragmented sleep architecture, you know they are going to wake up at 3 a.m. If they rely on a parent rocking them or a specific song playing to fall asleep at 8 p.m., they will demand that exact same sequence to transition back to sleep at 3 a.m.
Exactly. Teaching them to self-soothe builds a vital bridge between those fragmented sleep cycles.
And for older children and teens whose minds are racing, cognitive behavioral therapy specifically adapted for autism is utilized to directly target and dismantle that bedtime anxiety.
But sometimes behavioral adjustments just aren't enough to overcome the biological deficit, which is where targeted products come in.
Right. And the data surrounding melatonin supplementation is incredibly encouraging. When used under medical supervision, melatonin helps children with autism fall asleep an average of 28 minutes faster and extends their total sleep time by 21 minutes.
Which is huge. Reclaiming nearly an hour of rest for a hyper-aroused brain is a massive victory.
It acts as the chemical kickstarter that their brain isn't naturally producing.
Alongside that, sensory-specific accommodations are highly effective. White noise machines aren't just for ambiance. They create an auditory blanket that masks the unpredictable household sounds that trigger their startle reflex.
And we definitely have to talk about deep pressure therapy, like weighted blankets. We mentioned earlier how these kids are stuck in a sympathetic fight or flight state.
Yes, the weighted blankets are a game changer for so many.
The steady, evenly distributed weight of a heavy blanket provides constant proprioceptive input. Biologically, that deep pressure physically shifts the autonomic nervous system from sympathetic arousal to parasympathetic rest.
It basically acts as an anchor for a nervous system that is spinning out of control.
It's a holistic, multi-pronged approach. You are adjusting the environment, scaffolding the behavior, and providing targeted sensory support.
And it is crucial to note that clinical guidelines explicitly state prescription sleep medications must be treated as an absolute last resort.
Really? A last resort?
Yes. Utilized only when all environmental and behavioral approaches have been completely exhausted. This is due to the high risk of side effects and paradoxical reactions in neurodivergent brains.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? When a family finally cracks the code, when they get the room perfectly dark, the visual routines locked in, the sensory input managed, and maybe the melatonin dialed in, what is the actual payoff?
It is nothing short of a paradigm shift. The benefits extend far, far beyond simply feeling less groggy.
They see real developmental gains.
Huge ones. Clinicians observe vastly improved mood and emotional regulation. The child demonstrates a higher capacity for focus and learning in school. There is a dramatic reduction in daytime anxiety and the frequency of severe meltdowns.
Wow.
Suddenly, the child actually has the cognitive bandwidth required for social interaction and play.
It essentially acts as a multiplier for all their daytime therapies.
Exactly.
And for the parents and siblings, it is a literal lifeline. It pulls the family out of survival mode and reduces that crushing caregiver burnout.
Which is why community is so important here.
Right. Resources like the AngelSense community networks emphasize how vital it is for parents to connect with others who understand this specific grind, because implementing these rigid routines takes an immense amount of support.
This raises an important question, one that I think should fundamentally change how educators and clinicians view neurodivergent care.
Okay, I'm listening.
The data explicitly confirms that chronic, long-term sleep deprivation severely exacerbates autism-related symptoms. So, if a child is suddenly acting out, experiencing intense behavioral regressions, or missing cognitive milestones, how often do the adults in the room just assume it's part of the autism?
Wow. We just write it off as a symptom of their diagnosis.
Exactly. When in reality, what they might be observing are the brutal compounding symptoms of chronic, undiagnosed sleep deprivation.
That's chilling, honestly.
What if the master key to unlocking a neurodivergent child's potential during the day isn't a brand new, highly intensive behavioral therapy, but simply diagnosing the deficit and helping them achieve a better night's rest?
That completely flips the script on how we approach intervention. I mean, if we can successfully engineer the night, we might completely redefine what is possible for them during the day.
It's a completely different way of looking at it.
It really makes you think differently about Ashley standing there at the water cooler, doesn't it? She's not just exhausted. She's fighting a highly complex biological and environmental battle for her child's development every single night.
She's on the front lines.
She really is. To everyone listening, and especially to any parents tuning in who are living this reality right now, keep seeking those aha moments. We see the work you're putting in, and we genuinely wish you a good night and sleep tight.